Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Ajaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Kunjabi Hari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari Yasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yasoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Ajaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Astotra Sata Sri Sri Mata's Divine Grace Sabai Charnavinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Astotra Sata Sri Sri Mata's Divine Grace Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Kodi Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai All glorious to the assembled devotees All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glorious to Sri Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya Naram Shaiva Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jaya Mudirayet Nashta Prayeshva Badreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavat Yutama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Nashtiki. Good morning, everyone. Thank you. Thanks for coming, even those of you that didn't have a choice. We're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 7, the Scheduled Incarnations, text number 41. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sasatana na adi deva. Gayan gunanda sasatana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sasatana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kato varaye. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kato varaye. Gayan gunanda sasatana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sasatana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasyati nasya param.
Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sa satana na adi deva. Jesho dunapi samavasya dinasya param. Nam tam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste.
Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye.
Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sa satana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasya dinasya param. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Gayan gunanda sa satana na adi deva. Sesho dunapi samavasya dinasya param. Nantam vidamya hamami munayo grajaste. Maya balasya purushasya kuto varaye. Mayam gunanda sa satana na adi deva. Shesho dunapi samavasya dinasya param.
I will do the word for word.
Na.
Never. Antam.
End.
Vidami.
Do I know?
Aham.
Myself.
Ami.
And all those.
Munaya.
Great sages.
Agraja.
Born prior to you.
Te.
You.
Maya balasya.
Of the omnipotent.
Purushasya.
Of the personality of Godhead.
Kuta.
What to speak of others.
Avara.
Born after us.
Yea.
Those.
Gayan.
By singing.
Gunan,
the qualities.
Dasa satta anaha.
I think I got that wrong.
Dasa satta anana.
Sorry. One who has 1,000 faces. How many is 1,000? It's 1,000. Thank you. I was asking him. But whatever.
Adideva,
the first incarnation of the Lord.
Shesha,
known as Shesha.
Aduna,
until now.
Api,
even.
Samavasyati,
can achieve.
Na,
not.
Asya,
of him.
Param,
limit.
Limit.
Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada.
Srila Prabhupada ki.
Neither I, nor all the sages born before you, know fully the omnipotent personality of Godhead. So what can others who are born after us know about Him? Even the first incarnation of the Lord, namely Shesha, has not been able to reach the limit of such knowledge, although he is describing the qualities of the Lord with 1,000 faces. Purport. The omnipotent personality of Godhead has primarily three potential manifestations, namely internal, external, and marginal potencies, with unlimited expansions of these three energies. As such, the potential expansions can never be calculated by anyone, because even the personality of Godhead himself, as the incarnation of Shesha, cannot estimate the potencies, although he has been describing them continuously with his 1,000 faces.
Wow.
Wow is right.
It's just
a
little different, that's why.
Oh, mouths. Oh, it is different. The book, the hard copy of the book says faces. What can I tell you? Om Angyana Tamirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militamina Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Apadantikam. So this, I'm very happy to speak on this verse today. This is actually one of my favorite verses in the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, because it says quite clearly that the energies of the Lord, which are divided here, Prabhupada divides them in the purport here into the three categories of internal, external, and marginal potencies of the Lord, there's actually no end to their understanding. We can go on researching these things forever, and we will never come to the end of the qualities of the Lord's energies and the manifestations of the Lord's energies, both in the spiritual and the material worlds. The living entity, so what is the point, one could ask? If we can never actually reach the goal of understanding Krishna, what is the purpose of making the endeavor in the first place, I think is a fair question. But before we answer that question, I just want to talk a little bit about why can't we understand the full glories of the Lord. And the first reason is because the living entity in the material world, so the living entity, that's us and all of the other living things that we see, and even things, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's explained that the living entity is sarvagata, which means the living entities are everywhere. And Prabhupada writes in the purport to this verse that there's no place in all of the material existences where there are not living entities, right? I remember I was flying back home from Las Vegas. I was not in Las Vegas. I was in Death Valley, which is near Las Vegas, on a geology field trip when I was a master's student at the University of Florida. And it was like, we had just been out in the desert for 2 weeks, and I took a red-eye flight back from Vegas, and I was like super tired and exhausted and wanted to get home, and there was like a problem with the air conditioning on the airplane, so it was super hot and everybody was uncomfortable. And I was a little bit, I don't know, I'd say I was a little bit delirious maybe. But I was looking out the window of the airplane at all of these beautiful cloud formations that were beneath the plane. And I was remembering this verse from the Bhagavad Gita that the living entities are actually sarva gata. They're everywhere. So they're also pervading all of these clouds. And actually, these clouds are living entities unto themselves. We just don't really have the eyes to see it. For example, before about 1950, or let's say before the end of World War II, humans believed that there was nothing living in the oceans below a depth of maybe 100 meters or so. I'm speaking in meters again. Let's say 350 feet. because that's how deep the sunlight penetrates. And as far as we knew at the time, if sunlight couldn't reach a living entity, the living entity wouldn't live. We are all dependent on sunlight for our sustenance. In our biology class, we talk about autotrophs and heterotrophs. So autotrophs are living entities that are able to make their own food just by absorbing sunlight. These are plants. Everybody else, heterotrophs, we need to get our food from an external source. We need to eat. And what do we eat? We eat plants. So either way, we're getting our energy from the sun. And because the sun doesn't penetrate that deeply into the oceans, Human scientists believed forever, basically up until about 1950, 1955, that there was nothing living in the ocean below the depth that the sun would penetrate. And that was the limit of our knowledge at the time. So after World War II, humans started to master submarine technology. And we started to be able to go deeper and deeper and deeper beneath the ocean, far below where the sun can penetrate. Of course, now we know that humans have gone to the very deepest part of the ocean, the Marianas Trench, or the Challenger Deep is the name of the specific place in the Marianas Trench. And if you were to put Mount Everest in that trench, there would still be about a mile between the top of Mount Everest and the surface of the ocean. So that's how deep the ocean is. And the people who have gone down there, they saw all kinds of living entities. And when I say all kinds of living entities, I really mean some of the freakiest forms of living entities you can imagine. You know, and they all huddle around the warm places. But the point is that there's life everywhere. We just don't have the eyes to see it. So the living entities that live at the bottom of the ocean, they have a body adapted to that environment. And so there are also living entities that have bodies adapted to living in air or living in like these clouds, or even living in fire, like they're living entities in the sun, according to the verdict of the Bhagavad Gita. And in fact, the sun itself is a living entity, as is the earth, and so on and so forth. But every living entity in the material world is covered, and therefore our senses are limited. We experience this in a very practical way. For example, we were talking with our sixth graders last week about light. Anybody know the acronym for light that we can see? Roy G. Biv, who said that? That's cheating, Sean. The mask in the kids. Anyway. Yeah, Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. And the colors that we perceive are a function of the wavelength of the light that we're seeing. And so we see red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, a beautiful rainbow. But that radiation, the things that are making those waves, they actually extend far in the other direction away from the red spectrum and far in the other direction away from the violet spectrum. There's infrared light and there's ultraviolet light and so on and so forth. But we can't see it because our senses are limited, right? We can only see in a limited spectrum. It's the same thing with our sense of hearing. We can only hear pitches within a certain frequency of wavelengths, and we can also only hear pitches at certain volumes. Like yesterday, we were doing a little science experiment, and I put a little bit of hydrochloric acid on a piece of tin foil. And the hydrochloric acid started bubbling because it started dissolving the tin foil. We call it tin foil. It's really aluminum foil, but whatever. And the hydrochloric acid started bubbling. And I'm like walking around the class showing this to everybody. See, it's bubbling, it's bubbling. And then one of the kids said, oh, I can hear it too. It's making a sound. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they're like, no, you're crazy. It's making a sound. And I could not hear the sound because it wasn't loud enough. And so my ears are limited in this way. And their ears are not as badly damaged by loud music as mine at this point in their lives. So they're able to hear a wider volume of sounds. Some people actually can't tolerate very loud sounds. Like even sometimes I meet devotees here in this temple room that complain about, oh, the whompers are too loud. I can't take it. And they need to go outside, or they need to get earplugs to protect their hearing and whatnot. The same is true for eyesight. We see within a very limited range, but if I was an eagle flying in the sky, I would be able to see much further and much more clearly. So our senses are limited by the nature of the body that we've acquired. And even within the human form, there are different degrees or different faculties of the senses, let's say. So, you know, I need glasses to see clearly, because my eyes are not perfect. But there are many people here who don't need glasses to see clearly. So we're all awarded different bodies in this world with all different facilities for sense perception and sense gratification. But this is all by definition limited. We cannot perceive everything. It's not possible. So our knowledge of the universe, I like to use this analogy, maybe I've used it here before, our knowledge of the universe is asymptotic. An asymptote is a type of a graph that approaches a limit. It approaches a line, but it never actually reaches that line. The classic example of an asymptotic graph is the graph of the function y equals 1 over x. So I have a 1 and I divide it by x, and if x is super big, like if I make x as dang close to infinity as I can make it, the y value will become extremely large, and so the graph will become asymptotic on the y-axis. And if I make the x value very small, some fraction between 0 and 1, If I make the x value very large, the y value will become very small, and the graph will approach the x-axis as an asymptote. It'll get closer and closer and closer, but it'll never get there. And the same is true if I make x very small, some number between 0 and 1. The closer it gets to 0, the bigger the y value is going to get, but it can never get to 0. You can't divide anything by 0. That's just a math principle. And so our knowledge is like this. Using our own senses, we can perceive a little bit about the material world. And there's a method for perceiving the material world. For example, some people go to the shore. You know, you can go to St. Augustine or Cedar Key or your favorite beach here in the American Southeast. And if you look out over the water, it would appear as though the horizon is flat. And so some people look out over the horizon on the ocean or on a flat plain in Kansas or wherever, and they think, oh, the earth must be flat because I can't see the curve. But actually, these people just haven't been trained to see the curve. They don't know how to perceive properly. They don't know the scientific method of how to look or how to hear or how to smell or how to taste. There's a science behind perception. So with a little training, you can also go to the ocean. And if you watch a boat sail over the horizon, you won't see the boat just fall off the horizon, as it would if the earth was in fact flat. The boat kind of gradually goes over the horizon, and you see the hull disappear first, and then you see the lower part of the mast, and then you see the higher part of the mast, and then finally the whole thing goes over the horizon. And if you go up in a lighthouse on the coast, you can actually see the boat sail further before it disappears over the horizon because you're looking over the curve of the earth. And so without any training, you can look out at the world we live in and come to a conclusion. But with a little bit of training, you can come to a different conclusion. And the point here is that because our senses are limited, we always have a tendency to get things wrong. We make mistakes all the time. That is just human nature. We are going to screw something up today, for sure, guaranteed. Because our senses are imperfect, and because our senses are imperfect, first of all, we have a tendency to be an illusion. We don't really quite understand what's going on in the world around us. And because we don't understand what's going on in the world around us, we make mistakes. So these are some of the principal defects of human life that Srila Prabhupada has mentioned. And because our senses are imperfect, and because we're subject to being an illusion, and we make mistakes, but yet we still advertise ourselves as great learned people. And that is the fourth principal defect of human life, which is called to be a cheater, you know, to cheat people, to claim that I know something when in fact I don't know anything. I'll give you a real life example that happened not too long ago. One of our students, a few times over the last few weeks, started explaining to me how things work in the real world, and which I found to be humorous because this person is a child that has no real understanding of how things work in the real world. One could even argue that they've never spent a lot of time in the real world. The real world, by the way, is totally overrated. I spent a lot of time in the real world and I fled here. So the real world is overrated. But this is the cheating mentality, is that you think you know something and you advertise that you know this thing, but you actually don't know anything about this thing. And I don't mean to single any one person out. Actually, we are all like that. We are all possessed of a cheating mentality. And therefore, we live in a society of the cheaters and the cheated, right? Sometimes we are cheating other people, other times we are getting cheated. In either circumstance, we are not actually getting what we want. And what is it that we want? The soul is actually hankering for a relationship with Krishna. But unless we can free ourselves from these coverings and become not free from the defects, but immune to the influence of the defects in our lives, we will never actually get what it is we are really looking for. And so what is that process? That is the process of bhakti yoga. But before I get into that, I just wanted to talk briefly about the nature of the coverings that we have in our life. So the most basic covering that we have is what's called, these coverings, they're called koshas. The word kosha in Sanskrit means like a sheath. It's something that wraps something up. And the first one is the anamaya kosha. Anamaya kosha means that we are looking for food. We want to eat, right? You cannot maintain your body without eating. And so the first thing that every living entity wants to do in this material world is eat, right? So this is called the anamaya kosha. And this is humans have this, but all the lower types of living entities, the four-leggeds, the ones that crawl, the ones that fly, the ones that swim, the ones that are immobile, the plants, they are all looking for food. And until we get enough food in our life, we will never actually be able to advance too much further. One could debate how much food is enough food. Clearly in America, we're all overfed to one extent or another. But until that basic need is met, we can never really aspire for higher aspects of life. And the next sheath is called the pranamaya kosha. Prana is often translated as air or life force. And in this case, it's the air in our body that drives us to some sort of emotional satisfaction, the pranamaya kosha. So once our basic material needs are met, we have food, we have shelter, we start to endeavor for some kind of pleasure. And at first, that pleasure is on the very sensual platform. We want to look at something that appears beautiful. We want to taste something that is appealing to our senses. For me, that's pizza and ice cream. Other people have different tastes. The things that I like to put on my pizza, some people don't like to put on their pizza. We all have different tastes. And then we also endeavor for some emotional experience in relationship with another person. We want to have friends. Everybody's looking for friends. We maybe want to have a domestic partner. And with that domestic partner, we want to maybe raise a family. And this is all giving some kind of emotional satisfaction to the living entity, or at least the appearance of an emotional satisfaction to the living entity. But we also see that people get very frustrated with these. You know, I've had many friends. Some of them are not my friends anymore because of just frustration, like it didn't work out right. Anybody that's experienced householder life, and many of you have experienced more of householder life than I have, so I'm speaking mostly from watching my own parents and my own family. There's strife here. There's argument. There's challenges. There's, people when they live together, when they spend a lot of time together, they start to grate on each other a little bit, right? There's this saying that familiarity breeds contempt. When I know somebody too well, I also know their dark side too well. And now my emotional satisfaction is decreased. This person is getting on my nerves. And what do? Well, eventually we become frustrated, and we're like, oh, this is... And we become generally frustrated with the pursuit of sense gratification. We realize that what we experience as pleasure here in the material world is not really pleasure. It's a temporary cessation of suffering. So when I lived in Canada, this time of year in Canada, it is freezing cold. There was a day I actually just saw on my Facebook memories from a couple days ago. There was a day in Edmonton, where I lived in Canada, 2 years ago, where it was colder in Edmonton than it was on the surface of Mars. So that is cold. And, you know, and everybody who lives there, they've got a really nice winter jacket, and everybody's like showing off. I got my North Face jacket, I've got my, you know, Arc'teryx jacket or whatever, and people spend hundreds of dollars on these things. I was in a store in Quebec, actually, where they were selling, where they had these like full-length fake fur trim down coats. And it's like so attractive. It's like so elegant and fine and beautiful. And I'm just like, oh, wow, what a beautiful coat. And then I looked at the price tag of the coat, and it was like $1,500. I'm like, oh, my God. So even to get the type of enjoyment we're looking for comes at some kind of a cost. But so then what? I have this really beautiful coat, and now I'm an enjoyer. Ha, look at me and my beautiful coat. But actually, you're not really enjoying the coat. The coat is preventing you from dying in this case. If you didn't have that coat, you would freeze to death. And so the coat is not giving you enjoyment. It's preventing your suffering. And the opposite is true here in Florida. So the non-permanent appearance of heat and cold. So that's the cold. Here in Florida, if you've spent a summer in Florida, it is ridiculously hot. It's not only ridiculously hot, it's also unreasonably humid. And so what do? We fire up the air conditioning, and we go inside where the air conditioning is on, and we think, now I'm enjoying this air conditioning. But you're not really enjoying the air conditioning, you're alleviating the suffering of the heat. And so this is the nature of enjoyment in the material world. And even with more like direct forms of sense gratification, like I mentioned, I love to eat ice cream. And then once the lid comes off the ice cream and the spoon goes in, there's really no stopping. Right? It's like, oh, that first taste is so good. And it's giving so much pleasure to my tongue that I'm going for another one. Oh, let me have some more. And I'm eating the ice cream, and it's so enjoyable for my tongue. But after a while, it starts to become a real source of suffering for my belly. Because that's the nature of enjoyment in the material world. What at first seems like nectar, but then winds up as poison, is enjoyment in the mode of passion. And that's what we're all doing here, is we're enjoying in the mode of passion. And eventually, sometimes, if you're lucky when you're fairly young, if you're not lucky when you get a little bit older, we become frustrated with this whole pursuit. We're like, man, this is not working. No matter how much ice cream I eat, I am not satisfied. I always want more. I had this experience last summer when I tried to go on a road trip. I've been on road trips every summer of my life for the last 30 years, I'm going to say. And so I have this really false ego conception that I need to go on a road trip every summer, otherwise I'm not living my fullest life. But because of some injuries that I had and some just need to stay at home, really, I didn't go on a road trip last summer. And I remember thinking that the waterfall I'm looking for, wherever I go on my road trip, the waterfall I'm looking for, I'm never going to find it. I'm going to find a waterfall, but I'm always going to want to see another one. And therefore, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that wherever you go in this material world, from the topmost planet down to the lowest pits of hell, wherever you go, this world is a place of repeated birth and death where you are going to suffer. That's just a fact of life. You are going to suffer. There's no way around it. And so people, when they come to this realization, they start to ask questions about, well, how can I remove myself from the suffering? What is the solution to the situation that I'm in here in the world? And then we rise to the platform of what's called the Jnana Maya Kosha. We start to pursue knowledge as a source of satisfaction. And this is really where human life begins. We don't see even the other great apes of the animal kingdom sitting around reading the Bhagavatam. In fact, they don't even have enough developed language skills to read the Bhagavatam. And so this is a uniquely human endeavor to question the nature of my existence. Where did I come from? What am I doing here? Why am I forced to suffer in the material world? This is really where human life begins. Jnana Maya Kosha. And I think I mentioned the last time I gave class that Prabhupada said one time that even Socrates, by the power of his own mental speculation, became Brahman realized. Just using a process of logic, reason, and argument and the standard tools of philosophical debate and reasoning, Socrates was able to conclude that he was an eternal living entity, and therefore, when his jailers gave him a big cup of poisoned hemlock to drink, he said, Hare Krishna, bottoms up, glug, 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 I'll see you on the flip side. And he was not disturbed by this. He knew that he was not going to die, and this is all just a facade. So this is where human life begins. And when this Jnana Maya Kosha becomes mature, that covering is removed, and what's left is what's called the Vijnana Maya Kosha, and this is realized knowledge. So there's a difference between knowledge and realized knowledge. So realized knowledge is that it's just self-evidence. It's an understanding that you have that can't be taken away from you. So I forgot where I read it, but I read a couple days ago that if you need to look something up, you don't really know it. You know something when it just becomes a part of you, and when you can speak. Like I was reading yesterday in Shyamasundar Prabhu's book, the Chasing Rhinos with the Swami. He was talking about how when Srila Prabhupada first came to San Francisco, and I'm sure many of you know this story, but it's worth hearing again. When Srila Prabhupada first came to San Francisco, you know, the people there, they had never met him. In fact, Shyamasundar opened a temple in San Francisco without ever meeting Srila Prabhupada, which I find remarkable. But they were just so enamored with Srila Prabhupada, and one of them said he knows thousands of shlokas. He didn't have to study them. He knew them. He knew the shlokas, and he knew the meaning of the shlokas also. So it wasn't like he was trying to figure out or he was sitting there memorizing verses. It was realized knowledge for Srila Prabhupada, thousands of shlokas. It's amazing. Actually, sometimes some of my kids ask me, how do I know so much? And I actually, first of all, don't think I know so much. But how do I know so much? I read a lot of books, really. I've read a lot of books and I've listened to a lot of lectures. But is that realized knowledge? Not really. The realized knowledge would be the knowledge that allows us to remain in unalloyed and unadulterated devotional service all the time. That's the realized knowledge we're looking for. Our knowledge tends to actually drag us away from that to a certain extent. We want to watch the news, or we want to, you know, engage in so many activities. And we find ways to connect them with Krishna. We find ways to keep Krishna in the center. But if we had true realized knowledge of Krishna, we would never want to go away from Krishna ever. We would have an overwhelming hankering to constantly be in Krishna's association without any deviation. The gopis were cursing Lord Brahma because they had to blink. Right? And when that instant when I blink, I'm not seeing Krishna anymore. That's realized knowledge, is to know that Krishna is our best friend all the time. He's the maintainer of all of the universes. There's a third part here. I'm forgetting the third part. Bhoktaram Yagyatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshram and Suridam Sarvabhutanam Gyantamam Shantim Nichati. This is the peace formula, to know that Sarvaloka Maheshram. Krishna is the controller of all of these planets. We look up in the sky, we see so many hundreds and thousands of stars, and practically speaking, every star that we see up there is just in our own galaxy. And just to illustrate how unlimited knowledge of the material world can be, I tell this story sometimes when we teach astronomy. In the 1990s, when NASA first launched the Hubble Space Telescope, there was a problem with the mirror. So they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this telescope. They put it into orbit, started taking pictures of the cosmos, and all of the pictures came back blurry. And they were like, what in tarnations is going on here with this telescope? Why isn't it working right? And they realized that there was a problem with one of the mirrors. Like, one of the mirrors was manufactured with just a very, very small error. And because this scientific instrument is so sensitive, it screwed up the whole thing. And they're like, oh my God, what a waste of money. And they started to debate, what do we do about this? They thought, well, let's build another one. And they're like, nah, it's too expensive, it takes too long. And they thought even about sending the space shuttle up there, getting it, bringing it back to Earth, fixing it, and putting it back up there. And they're like, nah, that's too expensive too. We're not gonna do that either. And so then some smart people at NASA, they decided they would just write a computer code. So that they didn't change anything on the telescope, but they just wrote a computer code that would correct for the aberration on the mirror. And they thought, and they went up there and they did a spacewalk and they installed the new computer and they fixed it. And then they decided, we're gonna see if this thing works properly. And so they found an area of the night sky which they thought was totally black. An area of the night sky that nobody had ever photographed, and it was smaller than a dime. If you were to hold a dime out in front of your face, the area that they aimed the telescope at, which they thought was a completely dark, vacant area of the sky, that's how big it was. And they aimed the telescope at it, and they took a picture, which has now become one of the most famous pictures in all of modern science, called the Hubble Deep Field image. They took this picture, and what they saw in this picture were not hundreds and thousands of stars, but what they saw were hundreds and thousands of galaxies, each containing trillions of stars. And boom, and that just blew everybody's mind. And they realized, oh my God, this universe is way bigger than we thought it was. And so they started doing all this research, and for 20 years, 30 years, they did this research with the Hubble telescope. Technology advances, and they thought, oh, we're going to build a bigger one. And so recently, they've put the James Webb Space Telescope into the sky, and they start doing the same things. They start aiming it at the furthest reaches of the galaxy, or of the universe, that they can find. And the new telescope, of course, changes everything. It changes our whole understanding. Not our whole understanding, but it pushes dates back. It pushes boundaries back. And every time our ability to perceive material energy improves, our ignorance increases. We realize how much we don't know. I think I said this in a class before, too. John F. Kennedy said when he was launching the Apollo space program, the more our knowledge increases, the more our ignorance unfolds. And so, therefore, Krishna describes the material world as like a banyan tree. How many of you have seen a banyan tree? If you go to any golf course in Florida, you'll see a banyan tree. Don't ask me how I know that. Yeah, so banyan trees, they just grow and they grow and they grow, and it just becomes at some point this vast maze. And you don't know where it begins, and you don't know how to get out of it, and there's no beginning or end to it. And Krishna says we don't find our way out of this maze. We have to cut it down. We need to cut the tree down with the weapon of knowledge. And so that's why it's important to hear from the Bhagavatam regularly, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, that this is the knowledge that we have by which we cut down the tree of material existence and become free from all of these coverings of the living entity in the material world. So I'm about out of time. I'm going to stop there. Hare Krishna. There's really no need for that. Any questions or comments? We just got a few minutes. Narottam? You can just yell it out. I'll repeat it.
I was just wondering, they say Mount Everest is the tallest mountain on Earth, but that's just from sea level. So could the Arctic Circle be the tallest mountain under the sea that could possibly be taller than Everest?
Yeah, there are, in fact. Yeah, he's asking, he said that Mount Everest is the tallest mountain on Earth if you measure it from sea level to the top, but are there mountains that are taller if you include under the water? And the answer to that question is yes. Mount Everest is not the tallest mountain on Earth, it's the highest mountain on Earth. The tallest mountain on Earth is the Big Island of Hawaii, Mauna Kea. Mauna Kea? Mauna Kea, yeah. Kea, sorry. Any other questions, comments? Are you stretching or you want to ask a question? You're stretching. All right. We got a couple in the back here.
A few days ago, we had a quiz in the Srimad Bhagavatam class that everyone failed. And the speaker claimed that the fifth graders of the school could answer that quiz. So I was curious if that's really true.
What was the quiz? Are you talking about last week? Yesterday. Oh, what was the quiz? Let's see.
The quiz is, who's the predominating Vishnu deity of the days of the week? Say, like, Thursday.
Oh. I don't know. Any fifth grader? Srini Ketan.
I don't know all of them, but Monday's Krishna, Tuesday's Shridev, and today's Buddha.
Is Wednesday Buddha?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, wait. He was in fifth grade at some point. Nandini, did you have a question? We got two minutes or so. Did you want to say something while we're getting the mic over to...
It seems kids are going. I can give it to the kid.
Just yell it out for time. I'll repeat it. Oh. Sunday is Ram. Did we get it? All right, we have a mixture of grades getting it right here. Very nice.
So thank you. Thank you for the nice class. How do you explain that the Hubble telescopes can see?
Just hold it a little further away. The volume is up pretty loud, so just hold it a little further away.
How can you explain Hubble's telescope can see other universes, because it's way beyond 2 billion miles that we have been taught, and after that light cannot go through loka.
Well, this is, you know, this is a question that devotee scientists and scholars have been trying to answer since Prabhupada first translated the fifth canto, and my answer to this question is I really don't know. We had a seminar about this with the Bhaktivedanta Institute over the weekend, where Hari Kesh Prabhu, who had probably more association with Srila Prabhupada on this specific topic than anyone, and Prabhupada sent him all over India to try to find answers to questions like these. And nobody knows. And I mentioned this verse. It's like, what is the purpose of trying to figure it out to begin with? We are never going to understand it. It says it right here in the verse. We're never going to understand it. So what's the purpose of trying to figure it out? And devotees have different opinions about this. And I think on this matter, it is okay to have a plurality of opinions. The point is not to understand the universe. The point is to love Krishna. And sometimes by hearing about how the universe is structured, this can increase our love for Krishna. So if I may, just my opinion on this matter is that the purpose is to discuss these topics in the association of devotees. The purpose is not to know the right answer. If we need to know the right answer, Krishna will reveal it to us in due course of time. But really the purpose is to discuss these things in the association of devotees. Well, it could be like this. It could be like that. And we see over time, our understanding of these things actually develops. It used to be, you know, in the 80s and the 90s or whatever, people took Sariputta Prabhu's opinions on these things as sort of the gospel, let's say. But people have also researched what he's done, and so these things expand. And now we look at understanding the measurements in the Bhagavatam not as linear measurements, but as logarithmic measurements, or we look at them as not explaining physical distances, but degrees of progression along the spiritual path. And so this is the discussion that we have. But as we hear from Lord Brahma, and there are other verses also in this section of the Bhagavatam where Brahma is talking to Narada, where the same thing is said, that nobody can understand this stuff. Just before we have to stop, I would say that one area of scholarship that I think we can look into more, and I mentioned this in our seminar last week, and Hridayananda Maharaj, who was here and then did not agree to take over the giving of the class for me and left. So the first thing, and I'll make this real quick because we do need to go. The first thing is, what is a yojana? So in ISKCON, we accept as gospel that a yojana is 8 miles, but why is that? Why do we accept that? Is that something that Srila Prabhupada gave us, or is that something that we've just decided? But we do know in Vedic literature there are many different definitions of a yojana given. The other thing that we see in the fifth canto, where these distances are described, is that the nature of the language of the Bhagavatam itself changes quite dramatically. So most of the Bhagavatam is written in shlokas, which are the typical, you know, quatrains. Sometimes they become longer. Sometimes they become like the Brahma Samhita melody, like we had here. But in the fifth canto, where it's giving all of this astronomical information about the universe, the language changes entirely to prose. And what some of the scholars, Hridayananda Maharaj was in this conference, Advaita Prabhu was in this conference, so people who are knowledgeable in Sanskrit, they said that when Sanskrit language in Vedic scriptures changes dramatically like that, it signifies a change in the nature of what's being done. And typically as the verses get longer and more prosaic, the verses are becoming more allegorical. So this is just food for thought, really. These are just ways to frame the conversation rather than trying to derive an answer. I think we have time for one more comment or question. Prangovind.
I was thinking, the Bhagavad Gita says that the purpose of human life is to awaken love for Krishna. And also, at the same time, negatively should think that our senses are limited. We can't experience like other creatures. Like, for example, if there is a mice in one room, and then the snake in another room. The human, without light shedding on the snake, we have no clue that
yeah.
It's a snake. But the mice from the other room can actually hear the snake is moving. Hmm. And it's already started afraid and fearing, like how to escape from it. But we have no idea until we put the lights on. Oh my God, there is a snake.
Yeah.
So how limited we are, we should not be proud like, oh my God.
No, we should not be proud at all. We are totally limited. Even our vast scientific understanding of Big Bang and evolution and all of these scientific theories, the theories are maybe not wrong according to the nature of the observations the scientists can make, but what can they really observe? I mean, as a geologist, I can tell you that 99% of all of the rocks that have been made on this planet have been destroyed. You know, there's an area in the western part of this country called the Great Unconformity, where there's a missing gap of time in the geological record that in some places spans 1.8 billion years. You know, there's a rock formation here that is billions of years old, and then there's one on top of it that is a few hundred million years old. That is a huge gap of time. And so any civilization, any fossil, any living entity that lived in that gap of time, and this is not a small area, this is an area that spans the size of the entire Roman Empire, in fact. And there's no evidence of anything that existed there. So what do we really know? We see in the fossil record that, yeah, fossils go from simple to complex. That's an observation, and then based on that observation, we develop a theory of evolution. But what we are able to observe is so limited that it's actually foolish to think that the theories that we develop out of these observations are correct. You know, we were hearing about Galileo in the church. You know, the church was saying in the 1600s that the planets move in epicycles around the Earth. And Copernicus and Galileo came along and said, no, this is, they're all going around the sun. And, you know, Galileo was put under house arrest. And the church didn't apologize to him. He was put under house arrest, I think, in 1631. And the church didn't apologize to him until 1996. And long after the church accepted that, actually, he was right. But in fact, they're both right. It is possible. And at the time, the church had more scientific knowledge than Galileo did. They had been mapping the epicycles of the planets since Ptolemy. They had been mapping the epicycles of these planets accurately for 700 years. And even today, if NASA wants to shoot a probe to Mars or whatever, they're using Ptolemy's model of the geosystem, not the solar system, because we're on Earth and we want to go to Mars. And so they put the Earth in the middle, and this is 100% correct. So even within the scientific method, there are many ways to come to a right conclusion. But this is all relative truth. And there'll always be a new piece of information that comes in that changes the whole thing. That's the nature of science. Vedanta is different. Vedanta is conclusive knowledge. This is true. This is the fact of the matter. Bhakti Vedanta, the conclusion of knowledge is bhakti. The conclusion of knowledge is that we should love Krishna. And so therefore, Prabhupada said, and I think the last Rath Yatra he was at in the Western world, I think in Philadelphia, he was giving a speech after the Rath Yatra, and he said, if you want to understand this movement using logic and reason, we have so many books you can read. And we do have so many books you can read. And we should read them every day. But then he said, or you can take to the process directly and chant and dance in ecstasy. So that's the conclusion of knowledge, is that we should chant and dance in ecstasy and then have some golubchimins. Hare Krishna. I gotta go teach more. All right, well, thank you.